Hello and welcome to Baseball America's Draft Podcast. I am Carlos Collazo, joined as always by Peter Flaherty. What's going on, Peter?
Not much. I'm doing excellent. We are in the thick of everything. We're in the second half of the college season. The draft cycle is heating up. It's a very, very fun time of year across really all facets of amateur baseball. So no shortage of looks and storylines to follow.
Every time I start this podcast, Peter, I have the exact same intro, and it just puts all the burden on you to say something interesting.
So I have the exact same answer, too. I'm like, in essence, I'm just like, I really like baseball. So,
hey, that's never a bad place to start on a Baseball America podcast. So, yeah, here to talk some more draft today, a bunch of names maybe we haven't touched on, some news, some notes, some players trending up that we want to hit on. And we're basically just kind of going to talk through some things live. Me and Peter sometimes throw together a sheet of players we definitely want to talk about on each podcast, but it's a pretty loose structure in terms of how the show flows. I think that's a fun way to do it. But since our last podcast, I guess one of the biggest pieces of news was the injury to Max Ballew at Texas, outfielder, right fielder, one of the better pure hitters in this year's class, a class lacking on that skill set for college hitters. So that's a bit of a bummer. He's week to week. It's a thumb injury. It sounds like Texas is hoping that he'll be back in time for maybe some postseason play, but it just sounds like the thumb was giving him a lot of trouble in recent days and or weeks. Jacob has more on the side on exactly that injury situation, but I believe that's the most prominent injury nugget of draft eligibles this year. That's just at least worth mentioning because it is a bit of a bummer. I mean, we talked about a number of the college hitters who are at the very top of the board who've kind of been trending down early and just looking for these pure hitters we feel really comfortable with. And Ballew was hitting 358, 465, 642, six homers, seven doubles, striking out 21% of the time, walking 14% of the time. I think he was pushing himself up into the first round range if he wasn't like already locked into that range by a lot of scouts. He's at least getting closer to that range. So that was a bit of a bummer.
Yeah, without a doubt. Like you said, and I knocked on my wooden table as you did, but that is kind of the most notable injury to kind of that top group of guys, which I guess is sort of a good thing at this juncture. Hopefully that doesn't start a string of them. But yeah, like you said, he'd been a steady performer, had been playing his way into that first round range, like that 25 to 40-ish overall type of deal. And I'd say it's more of a, it's way more of a blow for the Texas team than it is his draft. Like, I really don't think this will hinder his draft stock all that much. Like, sure, missing these last six, seven, potentially 8 weeks of SEC play, you're obviously getting at bats out there and an opportunity to see your stock climb even further, but it's not really going to hurt him or ding him.
I think the one thing that maybe is worth like diving into a little bit is his conference numbers this year were not exceptional. Like, he was hitting for power, but the strikeout rate jumped to 30%. He was hitting 259, 333, 667 in conference. So still plenty productive just given the slug, the extra base hits he was providing. But I do think that getting a little bit more time in conference play to just try and minimize that strikeout rate over the course of the whole season would probably have helped a little, or at least allow him to continue pushing even higher. But you're right. I do think there is like a reasonable floor for a guy like Ballew for his profile and what he had done.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's fair to say his ascend has kind of halted. But I, like you had said, and I had said, he's still in a fairly good spot, but it would have been nice to see him against teams like Georgia, Texas A&M, meet of the SEC schedule to put some points on the board. But intriguing hit power blend, pretty, I'd say, appealing corner profile with a plus arm and right. He'll stick there long term, so he'll go in a good spot. Like, for me, I'd happily take him early in the second at this juncture. I'm not quite sure if I'd pull the trigger with him on my first pick, but nonetheless, still an appealing prospect.
Yeah, and then I guess the biggest, the buzziest name at this point on the draft side, in my mind, is Jack Bauer, who is the high school left-handed extravaganza who is throwing fastballs at 102 miles per hour, which It feels like the hardest throwing high school left-handed pitcher we've ever seen. I mean, we have a handful of high school right-handed pitchers who have touched the 102 mile per hour mark. Hunter Green, Chase Petty are two recent names who've gotten to that threshold. It's a really short list of high school pitchers who have thrown that hard, period. And earlier this week, before actually, this was the out after he had touched 100 miles per hour, I was putting together a piece on the site trying to contextualize just how rare even triple digits velocity was for a high school left-hander. And I couldn't find an official 100 mile per hour mark in any of our scouting reports for any top 500 high school lefty since 2018. And then I couldn't find an official 100 mile per hour mark for any first round high school left-hander dating back to 2000. The closest that I saw was Brandon Barriera, who was at 99 miles per hour. There were a handful of pitchers who had touched 98 miles per hour, either in, and this is either in our RBA draft reports where we mentioned top end velocity and like cross referencing, synergy and other data that we just have available. So names like Thomas White, names like Alex Clemmie, Cam Caminiti, Cameron Johnson, Noah Schultz, getting up to like 97, 98. And Alexander Clemmie mentioned that he had touched 100 miles per hour in high school. So like a couple of these guys, it wouldn't surprise me if Barriera had actually gotten 100 on a radar gun, or Alex Clemmie had touched a 99, 100. But regardless, he was in elite territory for pure velocity. And now at 102, he is in like historic velocity territory for a high school left-handed pitcher. Oh, and by the way, he can spin a breaking ball up to 3,000 RPM. So it's just a freakish arm talent.
Yeah, I mean, he's kind of in a class of his own, at least from a velocity standpoint from the left side. And you talk about, buckets he falls into and boxes he checks. And there's a lot of them. I mean, he's a projectable left-handed pitcher with, you know, I mean, he's got room to add 5-10 plus pounds of muscle going forward. But I mean, it's top of the scale velocity up to 102, and then like you said, it's kind of a bonus cherry on top. There's some feel the spin in there, a sharp slider, and I think he was in the low 80s and pushing the 28 to 3000 RPM range. Like, it still needs a coat or two of polish, but like the feel the spin is there. And it sounds like after the summer in which he struggled with strike throwing, like he's competing a lot better around the zone. So, I mean, it's a low effort look, relatively speaking, for a kid who's generating that premium velocity. Like,
yeah, I think that piece there is a huge key for me. It's like there's like maybe a little bit of effort, but the effort that he showed last year when he was touching 95 compared to the effort he's showing now, getting up to 100, 102 is not significant at all in my mind. Like, I mean, you'll get every pitching guru on the internet talking about how, oh, he's going to blow out because he's throwing hard. But these people say that for any high school pitcher who's throwing hard. It's just what we have to deal with. And I don't think it's a significant amount of effort. I'm mostly intrigued by, like, you mentioned his projection. You don't need to project too much on his stuff, but just thinking about how the body could add more strength and maybe some more ease to the operation comes in, or as he gets bigger and stronger, he just learns how to kind of repeat his mechanics. He's a pretty lanky, lean sort of pitcher now. And that control and command piece is going to be the biggest question for him moving forward, because the summer was a bit rough for him in terms of the consistency of the strikes with all of his pitch types. But I have to think that a number of teams are going to be really excited about taking an upside play on a guy like this. At Perfect Games National Showcase last summer, he was one of only two lefties to touch 95 at that event. It was him and Cruz Schoolcraft, who is currently the top left-handed pitcher on the high school side in the class. And he was one of only four players to have a breaking ball with a spin rate north of 3,000 RPMs. The other pitchers who did that, Reed Worley, Stephen Christopher, Patrick Dudley. So just having, like, checking off in bold Sharpie these velo and spin traits or tools or skills, whatever you want to call it, like not having to teach or train that velocity, not having to wonder if he's going to be able to throw a good breaking ball as a high school left-hander is pretty exceptional to start with. And I guess how much you view his ability to improve in the command and control department and how strongly you feel about your pitching development, being able to help him make strides in that department is going to ultimately determine like how high he goes.
Yeah, no, absolutely. All are great points. And like from an effort standpoint, there's a little bit of a head whack, I'd say, but it's nothing that you're like sitting there being like, oh boy, like this is tough. And from a physical projection standpoint, and you alluded to it, the stuff is already there. It's more so, you know, if he does add 10 or so pounds, it's like, is the operation going to get that much more easy? Is he going to stay connected more in his delivery? Cause like you said, he's like a long, lanky kid. Well, sometimes with a long arm action. So there's some stuff to clean up for sure. But you talk about like fun balls of clay to mold. He's kind of one when it comes to a still projectable lefty up into the triple digits already with field of spin, a breaking ball and a high spin breaking ball at that. So if you can refine the delivery, clean up the strike throwing a little bit and add in a viable third pitch, like, I mean, this is, he's got a real chance to have a really high ceiling. I'd say I would be stunned at this point if he makes it out of the first round based on no intel, but it's like,
I mentioned this too.
Like that's not gonna last.
I mentioned this to Ben when we were talking about this briefly on future projection, but I guess there's a chance that he goes out of the first round and gets paid more. But right. Even then, like to risk doing that, the team that wants to overslot him, every single team in front of you is going to be like, hey, they see the stuff just the same as everyone else does. And thinking through the left-handed pitchers who have gone in the first round in previous years. So just last year, Cam Caminiti, again, one of the harder throwing left-handed pitchers we've seen ever. Huge questions about Caminiti's ability to spin a breaking ball compared to Bauer. And Bauer throws harder. You could maybe say Caminiti is a significantly better pure pitcher. That makes sense to me. Cash Mayfield, 2024, went 25th overall. I think Bauer has more velocity, more upside with the breaking ball. Again, Mayfield, better pure strike thrower. Brandon Barriera. Barriera might actually be a reasonable comparison point here. Really different bodies, but in terms of like top end fastball velocity, high spin breaking balls, some inconsistency with the strikes with him, but was one of the better left-handed pitchers in his class in 2022. Noah Schultz in 2022 as well, going 26th overall. He took a really big step forward with his velocity as a spring or during the spring season. In 2021, we've got Frank Mazzucato, who was an under slot, number 7 overall. And then Maddox Bruns, 29th overall in 2021. Bruns is a guy, along with Alexander Clemmy, who I've been kind of bucketing Bauer with in my mind, because Bruns had just massive arm talent. He was getting up to 97, throwing multiple breaking balls, had a chance to be plus, and really struggled with his control. And then Clemmy didn't go quite this high. He was second rounder. Paid over slot, but also a guy who was, you're looking at a lanky lefty with a potential 70 fastball, 6 breaking ball. It feels like he's going to go in a really good spot. Someone's going to take a shot.
Yeah, and with Clemmy, like you said, he probably had the pure stuff advantage because, I mean, it was a plus premium heater and a plus breaking ball, but the command was below average and the delivery was all over the place, but 6'5", super projectable. And so Bauer hasn't beaten some areas, but an interesting debate just when talking about the left-handed pitchers in general in this class. And I've got my answer for it. Would you rather take him or Cade Anderson, like in your mid to late pick?
Oh, that's a really good one. It basically feels like, I would probably rather take Bauer. I think the upside, the shot on upside, it would be worth the risk for me. I think Cade Anderson is a very good pitcher, and I think there's a really solid shot he goes in the first round. But Bauer excites me a little bit more, so I think I would take him. Would you go with Bauer or Cameron Appenzeller, who we have in the back of the first round and was kind of a pick to click for a ton of scouts, and maybe a pick who already clicked for a lot of scouts who saw him in the summer. Super, super lean, lanky, lefty with good fastball, chance for a plus breaking ball. Maybe already has a plus breaking ball, change up.
Oh man, that's another good hypothetical. That's the one I should have posed, because it's prep lefty versus prep lefty.
No, I think they're both good to talk through.
And in kind of the same bucket. Man, that is a really tough one. I'd probably take.
So with Appenzeller, I feel like you have to project more on the stuff coming with him still. But I feel a lot better about just the command and control. So it feels like a safer chance to start, but I don't know.
Yeah, I mean,
I might just want to say, hey, I want to take an outlier here. We've never seen someone throwing this hard. Like, his upside is crazy. At the same time, I could easily see you saying, hey, this terrifies me that he throws this hard now, but I don't know.
I think it's, I mean, what we're doing right now, I think it's going to be a discussion happening in a lot of draft rooms and Zoom calls in the next couple of months, because it is a really fascinating debate. I'd probably take Appenzeller right now.
And what's the decisive, was there like one piece that was the determining factor for you there?
So I mean, when you kind of bucket these guys, and I've used that phrase now a couple of times on this podcast when describing Bauer, but with Appenzeller, he checks the left-handed box, super super projectable kid, more so than Bauer, more so than a lot of arms in this class, especially at the prep level. 6'5", 180, ton of room to fill out, both from a strength and physicality standpoint, and also from a what's to come stuff-wise standpoint.
Yeah,
the strikes are there. He's been up to 94. Breaking ball is flash plus. There's some feel there, developing feel for a changeup. I'm more confident in the longevity with Appenzeller than I am Bauer, at least at this point. And that could be a hot take, but it's a very interesting debate, though. Like, there's a more than viable and valid argument for either arm. And like, not to circle back to the own question I posed, but I'd probably take Anderson over Bauer as well.
Here's another one. How many lefties in this class would you take before you were staring at Bauer and saying, okay, he's next? There's a lot of interesting lefties. We talked about it last time on the pod. Like, I'm assuming you'd take Jamie Arnold. I'm assuming you would take Cruz Schoolcraft.
Yeah, so that's two.
Would you take Liam Doyle over him?
That's where I was initially going to go, because I know he's become more and more polarizing. Like, with Doyle, it's a rocket ship fastball. It's a comfortable six pushing a seven. It's got tons of late life. That split change is a really intriguing.
Yeah, I would say with Doyle, if you don't think his fastball is a seven, then I don't know what we're talking about with him in the first.
Yeah, I mean, it's a double plus heater, but it's like the how is a little weird. He can kind of spray it a little bit. He's looked more humid against lineups in the SEC.
The pulse? SEC. Yeah, excuse me.
Your words, not actually my words in the Slack, so it's still technically my words. But
I legit forgot that you said that. I wasn't even trying to...
I don't know. I it's hard to call like Cade Anderson a personal cheese ball, because I mean, he's been a prominent draft name for so long. But I mean, he's a slam dunk.
But he's a guy that you find yourself just really liking, and probably liking better than where we have him on the board, or maybe where even the consensus would have him.
Yeah, I mean, if I were picking in that like 20 to 30-ish range in the first round, depending on how the dominoes fall and who's there and whatnot, like, you can't really predict it. But if it goes sort of, I guess, somewhat according to the rankings that we have right now, I'm comfortably popping him 20 to 30. No doubt first rounder, fastball up to 96, tons of life in the top half of the zone. I think as of about a week and a half ago, it was a 44% miss rate on it, including 39% in zone.
This is
Anderson.
Anderson's fastball?
Yep. Anderson curveball is a six, plenty of depth and sharpness, and then the mid-80s slider has been a revelation. It's probably a 55 for me. It's got an advanced feel for it, can manipulate its shape, like, it strikes, it's stuff, easy operation. Like, I don't know, I'm a huge fan, and I'm in that 20-ish range.
So right now, ahead of Bauer, lefties, you're taking Arnold. Did you say yes on Schoolcraft?
Yep, Arnold, Schoolcraft, Doyle,
And you don't have to take Doyle. You can take Anderson and push Doyle. Like, which of the, you definitely would take Anderson before him. Yep. You said you would take Appenzeller.
Potentially so I guess, five.
Would you take Briggs McKenzie?
Oh, it's another good one. Another guy I really, really like. Yeah, I mean, I think in this exercise that we're doing, it speaks to the depth and I think amount of high-end talent there is when it comes to left-handed pitching.
I'll have to check and see like what is the draft that has had the most left-handed pitchers taken top 100 and see if we have a chance to break that or match that, because it does feel like a above average class for that demographic, maybe significantly above average. But as you were talking about fastball life, I'd seen this and I wanted to bring it up because I believe another like personal cheeseball of yours or a player that you really like is Joe Arriola at Wake Forest. I remember over the offseason we were talking about him a lot. Would it shock you to learn that as of this recording of the podcast, Joe Arriola leads all D1, I believe it's all D1 pitchers with at least 150 pitches in fastball whiff percentage, topping Sir Liam Doyle?
I think if you had told me that in whatever it was, December, January, it would be more eyebrow raising than I would be floored. Now, just given the way the seasons unfold, how Ariola has been throwing the baseball, I mean, strikes are in command is still kind of it's a clear issue, but
yeah,
he has a
48% fastball miss rate.
Yeah.
And Liam Doyle's, I guess, rounds to 48 is like 47.8.
Yeah. But when you initially told me that, well, because I think you dropped it in the Slack, but hearing it live for the first time, like that's rather surprising just given how everything's played out. I mean, Arriola will still go in a good spot because of the stuff. Mm-hmm. And like when he's on, it's really, really good. Like it's a plus fastball and a plus breaking ball and with a big sharp curveball, but like the strikes have long been a bugaboo. So it's like, can you develop the pitchability, make some minor tweaks to the delivery that'll help him compete in and around the zone more, but
and this is probably unfair to Liam Doyle, but for me, it speaks to how much his fastball whiff rate has dropped once he's gotten into conference play, because he started at such an exceptional rate. It was like a 60% fastball miss rate at one point after his first three starts, which is like, it's not a ton of time, but that's a decent sample.
It was nutty. I remember when we were like, when the Liam Doyle, I mean, when that rocket ship sort of just launched, like, I mean, the whiff rates were just like outlandish through the first 3 weeks of the season. It was like he was playing MLB The Show on beginner mode. But I guess if I'm taking five lefties before Bauer with Briggs McKenzie also right there, so it might even be six. How many are you?
I would. Okay. Yeah, that's good. I kind of was thinking through this. I was asking you, but mostly was just curious to hear what you'd say. So I would definitely take Arnold. I would probably take Cruz Schoolcraft. I would not take Liam Doyle. I think I'm personally lighter on Doyle than the industry, just because I have some more concerns about just the other pieces. It's just too unusual for me. So my next lefties that I would be looking at would be Bauer, Appenzeller, Briggs McKenzie, Cade Anderson, Zach Root, Joseph Jirwa. Okay, I'll table Jirwa and Root. So the next lefty that I would take after, who did I mention? Was it just Schoolcraft?
Schoolcraft.
I only have two that I've actually taken.
Yep.
Okay. Man, it gets tricky. I would probably take either Cameron Appenzeller or Jack Bauer. And I don't know, like, my heart wants me to take Jack Bauer because it seems like it's just more fun and exciting. But I do agree with you that there is some more like safety in the profile and some confidence that like Appenzeller is a real starter, even if you have to project a little bit more. So I'd be fairly torn. And depending on how this feels like I'm cheating, but depending on how like Bauer continues pitching, if he's just like around the zone enough to where we don't have massive, massive control questions, like I'm trying to think of the Vanderbilt pitcher who, Andrew Dukanich, the control questions he showed during his spring, if it's not like that crazy, I'm not saying that I need Jack Bauer to be pinpoint command, because I don't think we're going to get that with him this spring. Just around the zone enough. I think I might go Bauer and just take a shot on this real outlier velocity from him.
That's the
maybe key. I'm a prisoner of the moment.
Yeah, no, but I mean, it's hard not to be. I mean, it's a, as we've said, it's a one of one type deal with a lefty throwing 102 in high school. And he's not just kind of this one trick velo pony. Like, I mean, the fastball itself has life in the top of the zone, just shape wise. And he's also got this high spin breaker in his arsenal. But like, for me, I'll be really curious to see how the strike throwing and pitchability looks this spring, because I'm completely with you where it's like, if he's just competitive in and around the zone to a certain degree, like the stuff is going to play just fine if he is. But if he's and he looks more like what he did over the summer where it was a struggle, like that's going to, I mean, that would really, really scare me off, because at the end of the day, stuff is a ton of fun and it's easy to get enamored with really loud stuff and kind of outlier profiles from that standpoint. But not to be harsh, all it does is just buy you a little more time than the next guy when it comes to getting released. Like if you can't throw strikes, I mean, you're not gonna be a big leaguer. So
yeah, JJ had a piece on the site today just talking about the frequency of 96 plus mile per hour velocity, and it's almost commonplace at this point in the minor leagues. So while there is obviously a very strong correlation with velocity and just missing barrels, it is becoming more and more common. And yeah, you can't get too caught up in it, but it's going to be a fun one. Like just seeing Frank Mazzucato going to the top 10, like, why wouldn't Jack Bauer go to the top 10 if Frank Mazzucato went in the top 10 on a deal? So I really would not be surprised at any point. Like, I don't know what the like ultimate top end range for him going in this draft would, like what it would be that would be actually surprising to me.
I guess it all kind of depends on the strike throwing and how confident teams are in in his ability to be a competitive pitchability guy, because I think that'll determine a decent amount in terms of how high his ceiling is. But going back to JJ, because I thought this stat was just unbelievable. Jack Leiter yesterday topped out, I think 99.1. And that was the 53rd hardest pitch thrown in the Reds Rangers game by a starting pitcher. I had to read it like four or five times to like
understand. He had a screenshot of the pitch velocities too, and it's just like it's crazy to see it in like a visual.
I remember when I was little and I was a diehard Rays fan, and like David Price first came up, like him throwing 97, 98 from the left side was like a big deal. And like seeing like on the old like Fox Sports scoreboard, like the little flame and like red background when it was 95 plus, like that used to get me like fired up. Now it's like it's unbelievable, but I digress on the velo front. But it's such a fun crop of lefties, and it'll be interesting to see it kind of sort itself out as we go forward.
Yeah, and that pitcher too is Hunter Green. It's one of the few guys we can point to and say he did touch 102 miles per hour in high school. So I mean, the group of names that Bauer's competing with is a really short one in terms of being able to say, hey, I'm the hardest throwing high school pitcher ever. Just crazy. Okay, anyways, let's move on from this pitcher talk. A couple hitters we want to touch on. The one I probably feel most bad about not having mentioned, I don't know if we mentioned him at all on the podcast so far, but also kind of a snub from the Golden Spikes midseason watch list in my mind, but yeah, Alex Lodice at Florida State has been awesome this year. Pulling up his numbers here, he's currently hitting through 28 games, hitting 463, 504, 851, 11 homers, 10 doubles, 21.1% strikeout rate, 6% walk rate, playing shortstop every day for FSU, and by and large playing it pretty well. We had Lodice in our top 200 entering the year. As I look at our board now where he's at, he feels pretty criminally underrated. I feel like he's solidly at this point, like top two round status. And I've talked to some scouts in recent days who think he belongs like with the top tier of college shortstops in this class or not too far off from them. What are your thoughts on Lodice and what he's done so far this year, Peter?
Yeah, I guess I'll start by saying, I mean, no doubt top two rounder for me at this point and trending higher. I mean, you mentioned the numbers, but I think what's been the most interesting development in his game has been the improvement in his power output. And I looked into it a little bit more over the weekend after his he had another great series against Notre Dame. But he's lifting the ball more. I think the fastball line drive percentage since last spring has grown from 50
or fly ball line drive, or
yeah, did I say fastball line drive?
He did. We got fastballs on the mind on today's episode. It's understandable.
Yeah, his fly ball line drive percentage has increased from 51% to 62% since last spring, and I think that's enabled him to tap into his above average power to the pull side more. In the hit ability, I'd like to see the hit tool add a coat or two of polish, particularly as it pertains to picking up shapes and spin out of the hand. I mean, there's some tendency to whiff on breaking balls both in the zone and then also expand it both down and out. But it hasn't hindered his production, at least to this point. And I think he's got an above average arm over at shortstop. He's comfortable attacking the baseball and throwing on the run from multiple arm angles. So
he had one play where he made kind of a jump throw in the hole, the classic Jeter play, that like the carry he got on his throw from a midair position with his weight going back towards the left field line was really impressive to me.
Yeah. And I mean, that was like, that was a legit Jeter play. So, I mean, I mean, he's not like this buttery smooth defender, like over at shortstop from an action standpoint. But I mean, I think, I mean, I'm confident enough in his ability to stick there. And I think like adding a coat or two of polish to the hit tool and cleaning up the swing decisions as a whole is only going to enhance his offensive upside, especially with this improved power that he's shown this spring. So as you had said at the jump, no doubt top two round guy. I'm curious to see, assuming he continues to produce it, even just like half of the clip he's been able to right now. I'm curious to see how good he ends up going, because I don't think the first round is at all out of the question when all is said and done.
No, I think really with this class, we're seeing like once you're in that top two round conversation, the tier breaks are so insignificant or non-existent that like once you're there, it's wide open for me. And what's interesting with Lodice is his cousin, Kyle Lodice at Georgia Tech, also having a pretty monstrous year. They have different physicalities and different offensive profiles. Kyle seems to be a much more selective hitter at the plate with good contact skills, whereas Alex, as maybe was indicated by the way you were talking through some of the polish you want to see added to his offensive profile and just like the pure walk rate that he has, he likes to swing a lot and he swings a lot out of the zone. Kyle does not do that. His approach has been pretty solid dating back to his days at Augusta. I think even in the Cape, he didn't have a great stint on the Cape, but I believe his plate discipline was still pretty solid there last summer. You can correct me if I'm wrong, Peter, but Lodice right now, or Kyle Lodice, since we're talking about both, both cousins, he's hitting 390, 497, 856 with 12 homers, 15 doubles, as many walks as strikeouts, 22 of each, seven bags without being caught once. Like, I know, or at least I've heard, and it sounds like Alex just has a different sort of tool set and physicality and power upside. But at the same time, those plate skills from an ACC shortstop like Kyle, for a guy who's going to have a chance to play shortstop moving forward, there are going to be teams that really value that as well. And I wonder how far he's pushing. And I just think it's cool that we've got a couple cousins in the ACC doing this. We've got the Witherspoon brothers. We've got JoJo Parker and Jacob Parker. We just got a lot of familial ties and like legit prospects from all the relatives this year. It's not like this guy's kind of getting a little courtesy mention, but is not a real dude. Like, these are all going to be guys ranked on our top 500 list, or I think they're actually all are at this point.
Yeah, no. And with Kyle, it's an intriguing profile as well. It's more hit than it is power. I think you could very reasonably argue a 55 hit on Kyle Lodice, plus bat to ball skills. I think he's making contact at a 90% overall clip in the zone, chasing it less than a 20% clip. It's like fringe average raw power. I think playing and I'm not calling him a Georgia Tech or a metal bat merchant by any means, but I think playing in a hitter friendly environment is certainly served him well.
I think given your current environment and given the bats in college baseball, it would almost be fair to call them all metal bat merchants until they prove otherwise.
That's fair enough. Have
some skepticism for them as they enter pro ball, and let's see what they do with the torpedo bats.
Oh, God bless. But yeah, I mean, he's a good athlete. He's a plus runner. There are some fun tools there with Kyle. I don't think it's like necessarily as loud as it is with his cousin Alex, but again, he's a guy that figures to go somewhere in a decent spot on day two. Well, I guess now it's all day two, but I think anyone listening to this knows what I mean by that, like inside the top 10 rounds in a good spot somewhere. But
the lingo for bucketing players, like I'm just gonna have to just start using round ranges instead of days, because it is confusing, especially if you're talking, like if we're going to talk historically, like having people know, like, okay, when 2025 happened, day one meant this, but 2024 and previous day two meant this. So like it is annoying, but I guess we'll just have to make that adjustment.
Yeah, and I think circling back to Alex, I'm intrigued by his power upside, because like there's bat speed in there. He's lifting the ball more this year. It's above average to the pull side. I'm curious to see what it looks like when all is said and done. Like, he's not this like wiry, uber projectable kid, but he's got a good looking athletic body. I was a fan of it when I saw him live on the Cape last summer. But yeah, I mean, if the hit tool can even just tick up by half a grade, and you know, you can just polish up the swing decisions, like this is a really, really appealing up the middle profile for me.
Yeah. All right. I wanted to also ask you about another outfielder that I believe you're pretty excited about or pretty high on, and that's Arkansas's Charles Davalon. I don't know if I'm pronouncing the name incorrectly, but I feel like there's like three different pronunciations I could have gone with.
Yeah. Davalon.
And he is currently leading the SEC in hits, I believe, and has been just pretty impressive this year, currently hitting 402, 486, 672, nine homers, four doubles. He's got 17 walks, just nine strikeouts, only a 6.3% strikeout rate. I would imagine that's one of the better marks of like regular hitters in the conference. Nearly a 12% walk rate. What do you got on Davalon?
I really, really like this kid. And I think it's hard not to, especially seeing what he's done this spring at Arkansas, but I liked him a good deal last summer on the Cape, flashed some of the tools he has. And I think it's an appealing blend of tools and performance, because you're not looking at a guy that's going to overwhelm you from a tool standpoint. Mm-hmm. But for me, it's plus hit. I mean, he's making contact right now at a 91% overall clip. Just in general, there's a real feel for the barrel, good adjustability in his swing. He uses the entire field. And I think what's most interesting offensively with him, and you look at the body type with him, he's obviously undersized, but he's got this compact strength and physicality kind of packed into his frame. And he's got some juice to the pull side. He's posted EVs a handful or a few, over 110 this spring. Like there's some pull side thump there. He runs well once underway. This summer I actually saw him a good bit in center field. Like he's not a pro center fielder for me, but like he could go and get it like from gap to gap. There's legit range and closing speed. They've got him in left field, at Arkansas, where he's fared well, this season. And it wouldn't shock me if when all is said and done, he ends up back on the dirt, at second base, which is where he started at Florida Gulf Coast. So, I mean, there's some versatility there defensively. He's a good athlete. He's kind of this baseball rat, hard-nosed, tough kid who plays the game really, really hard. Again, plus hit, feel for the barrel. I think he's going to go in a really good spot, or a pretty good spot at least, early to mid day two. I like him a lot, and like the makeup with him is a cherry on top to everything.
Yeah, Quebec, Canada native. Went to TNXL Academy, went to Florida Gulf Coast before his time at Arkansas, and a draft eligible sophomore this year. So pretty fun one. Any other names or any other draft topics you want to get into today, Peter?
In the sake of saving us some material for the weeks going forward, I'll hold off on mentioning.
Keep some of your sleepers back.
Yeah, I think the 40-minute mark is a good spot, but
cool.
There are a handful of guys I know we'll both want to touch on going forward. So I'm excited for the next handful of weeks.
Yeah, absolutely. And then just to plug a few things, it's kind of all, we're firing on all cylinders on the website these days. We've got the minor league season started up, at least in part. And by the time you're listening to this in earnest, we've got tons of content from the pro side. If you are looking forward to seeing who kind of turned some heads by the scouting community in spring training, Josh has his annual magnum opus. I think 50 players who are up arrow guys are just buzzing from spring training to know. And a part two of that piece is coming. Peter's been all over the underclass college names on the college side. Jacob's been doing college coverage weekly as normal. Ben has new international content, which teams have the most international signings. We've got 2027 rankings. We're going to keep updating the current list. We have 2026 rankings. So as Peter says at the close of every show, we've kind of got you covered at all phases of the game, and I'll save him the pitch unless he has anything he wants to add here.
I was going to say, I love it. You, that was, I'm happy. I don't need to give my same spiel on a week to week basis. That was perfect. There really is something for whatever you like.
Cool. All right. Well, that's going to wrap it up for us today. Thank you guys for hanging out. Thanks for listening. Thanks for supporting Baseball America. For Peter, I'm Carlos. Have a great weekend, and we'll see you guys next time.